Hard Knock Radio. If you listen to Hard Knock Radio, you hear he really brings some topics there for discussion. So, I'm not a great introductory, but I'll do the best that I can. So, on our far left, we have George, who's started All of Us and None. Co-founder, I'm sorry. He's the co-founder of All of Us and None, very active in the community. We have Jasiri X from Philadelphia, who is a political conscious rapper.
Pittsburgh,
I'm sorry. I said Philadelphia, huh? Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I'm going off the top of my head with everybody. Very conscious political rapper. Matter of fact, he was the very first one to do a rap video on the murder of Oscar Grant, which he will share when he comes up. We have, of course, Elaine Brown, who was a member of the former Black Panthers, as we know, first and only female to lead the Black Panthers. We have here also to her right is Fred Hampton Jr., the son of Chairman Fred Hampton in Chicago, great brother. And of course, we have Minister Keith Muhammad of the Nation of Islam, also a representative of the Oscar Grant movement, been very outspoken and in the forefront of that movement, and just a very powerful brother. And then we have Dr. Siri Brown, just a fantastic person, teacher, and love us, you know, and is thorough on our history and where we should go. And what I'll do now is really turn it over to David D. And what he's going to do is basically give each of the panelists an opportunity to talk about the question that he's going to pose for about maybe 5 or 7 minutes per question for each individual. And this is to stimulate some thought for you, the youth here, so that as the youth come up and begin to answer these questions, you will have in your mind not only the problems that we're dealing with, but also some ideas concerning the solutions that will help us move forward in our community. So with no further ado, I would be very remiss to not introduce Sister Beatrice, who is the director of the Oscar Grant Foundation, who partnered with Youth Uprising to bring this event here. So much love to her and her hard work in putting this together. And if you're not aware, there are some treats. We have some food over there, some drinks. I'm not sure what, but you can help yourselves. So no further ado, David D.
All right. I want to kind of keep this conversational because I know when we just talk at each other, it can kind of drown people out. But I want to just get right into it. It's 2011, and this type of conversation about crime in our community, black on black, brown on black, and black or brown on black, or black on brown, is not a new conversation. I mean, I've been in meetings here in Oakland 20 years ago where we were talking about the same thing. And so I think many of our panelists have been involved in these types of conversations at various points in their work. And I guess what I would want to start off with is, what do you think has worked over the past years that you've been doing this type of work in terms of trying to bring some sort of solution together? And what has been the biggest challenge that we still are having this discussion in 2011? So let's start from there. And we'll start off with you, George. Do we have another mic that they might be able to use? I want to get it on mic so we can get this recorded so that we can get your voice and everything, but I'll start off with you, George. And you know, I've been with you for many, many years, so you've done a lot of work, you know, with Barrios Unidos, among other things, and so you've seen this before. What has worked? Why are we still in this situation? There you go.
Honored just to kind of share a stage with so many powerful folks right here, and I see some really powerful people out here in the seats too. So, you know, I just think it behooves me to just kind of acknowledge that from jump sheet. In terms of what works, you know, what happened is not a lot has really changed in terms of power structures. And we know what works in our communities, and we keep trying to kind of navigate things, I think, through sort of a nonprofit industrial complex. And there was a conference of the theme that said, you know, the revolution will not be funded. And I think we realize that, but somehow we still try to operate through that system and that apparatus to try to create transformative change. Transformative change isn't going to come about in that way, you know? And so, you know, part of the challenge, let me actually address the question directly in terms of what we know what works in terms of my community. I represent, my background, my heritage is American Indian and Latino, and I recognize my indigenous side from South America as well. And so, what we know is that cultures are healing, cultures are strength, and cultures are recovery. And so, you know, our elders tell us that you don't really know where you're going unless you know where you've been. So reclaiming, recovering, relearning our culture, our traditions, those, you know, the teachings of our ancestors, returning to those teachings is part of what we know works with our young people. We know that there are, that hurt people hurt people. So when we look at the issues on the streets in terms of a lot of the violence that's happening, whether it be in Fruitvale or in the Deep East, black on black, brown on brown, a lot of that is due to historical intergenerational trauma. We have in our communities what's called post-colonial stress disorder because of legacies of slavery and colonialism. And so there's a need for a lot of healing. And there's been a lot of political movement, there's been a lot of different kinds of things, but what we also need is a spiritual movement to take time to heal our hearts and our spirits to recover from that. And so that's part of what we know works in our community that we've been doing, and we've been going back to the ways of our elders. We take our young people into the sweat lodge to take time to pray, to feed their spirits, include ceremony in their life, to go back to those fundamental values so they don't just internalize sort of Western dominant culture society's values of maximize profits, minimize expenditures, because in our community we have an expression that of all our relations. We are all related, and there's an interdependency that comes from that. We recognize that we can't not just have respect for ourselves within our own circles and also build meaningful multiracial alliances, but that it's also beyond just the human race, but it's also about all of our relatives, our winged relatives, our fish relatives, our four-legged relatives. You know, that we're all inextricably linked to this, and that we pray to the grandmother Earth, to our creator up in the sky. And when people talk about climate change and people talk about the Mayan prophecy of 2012, what our elders say is it's not supposed to be the end of the world. In fact, this is supposed to be a time of renewal and regeneration, a time of great cleansing. And Mother Earth is doing what she got to do to heal herself, because we've been doing a lot of things to put her out of, you know, on balance. And so now she's taking that time to warm, cool over here. And there might be some negative externalities associated with the way she's doctoring herself. But, you know, but it's actually a time of healing. And so we're taking that time. We see this as a time of prophecy. We see the year of 2012 as marking a time of prophecy. And we see this as an opportunity. All it is an opportunity. It's no promise. That's all it is. It's an opportunity. And so, you know, we're taking time to relearn those teachings, to pass those on to our young people, and we're trying to build with other communities. But what often happens is we get so consumed. We get, you know, it kind of like in the words of Fannie Lou Hamer, we get sick and tired of being sick and tired, but we're just consumed with what's immediately reacting to the agenda of the dominant culture of the oppressor, and we don't take time to actually really build with each other. There's no integrated collaboration. You know, some of these folks on the stage, I'm just, you know, I haven't really connected with, and yet they're doing phenomenal work. So why is that? You know, how are we creating and building together so that we're not just focusing on our own backyard?
Right.
We have to clean up in our own backyard, and we got to do that first and foremost, but at simultaneously, we also have to take time to build with each other. So
I want to pass this over to Elaine. I want to kind of alternate a little. You know, Elaine Brown, when we look back at the legacy of the Black Panthers, for many of us, there's a perception that there wasn't any crime in Oakland, there wasn't any crime in our community, and at the very least, there was a culture in which life wasn't seen as being something that was so disposable and cheap by, you know, within our communities. That's how we perceive it. We don't know, because we weren't there, many of us. So maybe from your perspective, if you can let us know, you know, how it was when you're doing what you were doing in Oakland, dealing with the police. Were we actually going at each other in a way that it seems to be ravaging us today? And what was working with you all, and why are we at this point now?
Well,
The first thing you have to know, in order to, what we learned in the Black Panther Party, and I know my comrade brother sitting next to me, Fred Hampton Jr., knows this from his own father, is that in order to have a solution to a problem, you have to have a correct analysis of what the problem is. So when you use the word crime, the first thing you have to know is that crime is a political question, and it's not a moral question. To kill someone is not a crime, because you can get a medal if you go into Libya and kill some Libyans in the name of the United States of America. So we know that that's not a crime, is it? If you're given a medal for that, you might kill more people in Libya. And when we talk about black-on-black crime, I think the greatest perpetrator of black-on-black crime today is the Obama administration bombing an African country that has done nothing whatsoever to this country. Now, if you don't want to recognize that, you probably don't want to be sitting here in the first place. So when we talk about the street so-called crime, we use the definition that the oppressor uses, defining us as criminals, while he is sending many, many soldiers throughout the world to areas of color and murdering people in the name of freedom. So you got to get it straight in the first place, what we are talking about. And, you know, I just want to mention that Martin Luther King said that America was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world, and it remains the greatest purveyor. So what is it that a child should learn on the streets of Oakland? I would like to know how a brother on 98th Avenue gets a hold of a Uzi when a Uzi is made in Israel. Because were you in the Israeli army and you came back and you brought a couple of trinkets with you? I mean, how do you get an Uzi out on 98th and East 14th? I don't know. We all know what the truth of that is, don't we? So let's not criminalize our own people, but let's have a correct analysis of what is going on here. That's the first thing. I'm not here to criminalize anybody. Now, we used to say in the Black Panther Party that in order to get rid of the gun, it may be necessary to take up the gun. So when we saw the brutality of the police perpetrated against our people, Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale and others and some sisters strapped themselves down and walked the streets, but they did not walk the streets against our people, because we had come to that place where we recognized the difference between our enemies and our friends. And sometimes we don't do that. Now, I'm going to say this very quickly. Yesterday, I got a call from a brother in the joint in Georgia where I'm working with a lot of people, and he's a Muslim, and I say this because the Muslims in that particular facility got into a fight with some gangster disciples. You got gangster disciples, Crips, Bloods, Muslims, Rastafarians, you name it. They're all sets inside the prison system, as I know my brother will tell you, that all those sets are inside. Now, they got into a fight over some cell phones. A brother got stabbed and killed. What's wrong with that picture? Does nobody realize that not one person in that set, Muslims, gangster disciples, or whatever they want to call themselves, in control of anything in that prison at all, not even their own bodies? They go to the bathroom when they get told they can go. They take a shower when and where. They eat what they're told to eat. Don't eat it if you don't want it, but that's all it's going to be, blah, blah, blah. And yet they would fight over a cell phone. Now here on the streets, you talk about the set that's over here at the Hooby Boo corner and the Hooby Boo corner, as though some black people are in control of anything in the city of Oakland. This is Mr. Kaiser's plantation, whether you realize it or not. And don't nobody in this room, nobody control anything on the streets of Oakland. Yet we will fight as though this is my set, my neighborhood, as though you have something to do with the oil, gas production, the cell phone towers, the food, or anything else that's going on. So in order for us to talk about what is the problem, we have to have a correct analysis. And what the Black Panther Party understood is that we realized, yes, we had fights among blacks. When I grew up, old as I am, shoot, on the streets of Philadelphia, I was living in the Avenue territory, and that covered four square blocks. And if you didn't live in the Avenue, you better not walk through the Avenue. And it's like that in Pittsburgh, I believe, because Pennsylvania has a tendency to be a little, you know, it's rough. Philadelphia's a rough city, is it not, Brother Jassiri X? Philly is not a joke. If you didn't live there, so you, if you were a girl, you couldn't go out, you couldn't see a boy who was in the valley next door. or the village, or you couldn't go up the street and all kinds of stuff. People got beat up, but people didn't have guns. So you had gang fights, you had gang war. Yes, people had these kinds. This was urban warfare, which comes out of the first and second migrations. How you think you got here? This just landed here by some miracle? No, you got here because of migrations from in, here in Oakland, from Texas and Louisiana, because your great-great-grandparents were trying to get a job on the docks of Oakland. And then you got locked down in these little areas, and you nobody gave you a job anymore, and you thought you were the problem. And so America has, for the last 15 or 20 years since the Clinton administration, been telling you that you are the problem. America's a great place, you're just not trying hard enough. You would be Oprah if you just believed and worked hard. You remember Nas talking about, you too can be Oprah? Some of those silly conversations like this. So I think the first thing we have to do is then and now, the difference is simply this. We had the good, we had the conditions that were right for change. We don't have the same conditions. We are being fooled. We had a black man in the White House and we think that change has come. So we're being mesmerized by propaganda. And it's up to you to cut through the propaganda, make a decision that this is nothing wrong with you. There's nothing wrong with young people. All these little fights and so forth, yeah, they're resulting in some violence. But black on black crime, the biggest crime in America is white on white in terms of criminal statistics. Yet black people represent 50% of the prison population. So we know that's a crime in and of itself, isn't it? So we have to recognize that we are not the problem, but we represent the only solution for ourselves if we want to do that. We can get down with each other, or we can let our oppressor do the work, do nothing while we fight each other and maintain that sort of thing. But we are not criminals. We are people who have been treated in a criminal way and are an oppressed group. And until we recognize that as the analysis, we will be looking for the wrong kind of solution. We will be condemning each other when we need to love and uplift each other.
Okay. Chairman Fred, let me ask you. City of Chicago this year has been in the news because, you know, the headlines that at least make it outside of Chicago, 78 killed in one weekend, 42 killed this week. And it's made it seem like, you know, every day there's carnage going on in that city. The city that is home to the President of the United States. And one would wonder, you know, how that happening on his watch? You know, that would be one question I would ask. The second thing is that Chicago has always been a cultural hub. It's also been a home of great organizing and many legendary folks who are very politically astute and aware. And so obviously we know that there are people like yourselves that don't sit back and allow that sort of carnage to go on. Without putting up a fight and trying to change the direction. So I'll start off with asking, what is going on in that city, and how are you and others dealing with it? And then I want to also just kind of juxtapose that, because Sister Elaine had talked about outside forces contributing. And one of the things that we notice is that, you know, starting tonight, we can turn on the TV and we can watch 12 hours straight of Gangland. And among that will be like every single set that Chicago has ever had will be profiled. Latin Kings, Gangsta Disciples, this one, that one, and the other one. So they highlight those sorts of things to the point that you have people in other cities that look and go, I want to be just like that. I want to be a Four Corner Hustler. I want to be a Vice Lord. I want to be those types of things. So maybe you could speak to some of the phenomenon that's going on in a ground zero type of place right now.
First and foremost, let me say I'm honored, humbled to be here also. I just literally got off the plane. I was a little sluggish for a minute, but I'm charged up now. well said to the panelists who spoke before me, well said. As you pointed out, I'm based in Chicago, Illinois, and there's been a lot of propaganda put out, you know, that gives an impression that, you know, that individuals from our community, that just fighting, that we exist in some sort of vacuum. We just, you know, these street gangs, like what we like to refer to as the street tribes, just fighting amongst each other. But again, just to touch back with Lane, since Lane had pointed out, but it's important that we give a correct analysis. For Field Marshal George Jackson of Black Panther Party said capitalism not only affects the economy, but it affects the psychic of the people. Not only affects the economy, but it affects the psychic of the people. And this politic, this parasitical politic that we all are subjected to one way or another, capitalism, it's for lack of better terms, it's a pimp whore type politic. It's a parasitical politic. It's a politic that that in order to be a successful ward, a lot of people got to be locked up. In order to be a successful dope dealer, a lot of people got to have habits. So one comes at the expense of another. Chicago has a history of, you know, a structure, you know, organizational structure. And it's important that not just with the street organizations, even with the different the religious factions, or progressive organizations, America's policy, whether it be in Afghanistan, whether it be in Iraq, whether it be Detroit, Chicago, Oakland, America's policy is to create chaos and restore order. That is America's policy.
Can you repeat that again?
Create chaos and restore order. Create chaos and restore order. A lot of people, when we say terms like, and I chair an organization called the POCC. A lot of people refer with the Panther Cubs, and I'm a stickler for structure. A lot of people say, I say Chairman Fred, Minister UEP Newton, so on and so forth. There's some sort of ego trip. No, structure, and forgive me, structure identifies state shit and stops a lot of bullshit. Structure. Anyone that tells you, to someone that is working at your disadvantage, their first thing is to take away your structure. Like when America goes to Iraq, they put up this propaganda saying that this doesn't make a difference if you're a Shiite or a Sunni Muslim. When I was doing Saddam Hussein, that wasn't half the problems going on in Iraq that's going on over now. And in Chicago with the street organizations, the former U.S. Attorney Jim Burns said when they vamped on an organization that was once known as the Gangster Disciples, who later changed the name to Growth and Development, when he vamped on the leadership, Larry Hoover, he said at the press conference, prepare yourselves for nationwide violence. There's a program called Operation Headache. This was 1996 when the federal government made their move on the GDEs. And I was locked up with some different guys on a region place called Centralia. We call it Clantralia for the amount of white nationalism that goes on in this particular camp. And within a moment, the GDEs was like a formation of different street organizations that merged together. When they vamped on the GDs, you could see the effects within minutes. For example, they had policies within the GDs, like they couldn't, what they call community smoke, with the pass of cigarettes, and they couldn't, it's a demoralizing way that the guards would try to make you do a strip search. These are policies they would not adhere to that. As soon as the structure was taken away, you see all type of antagonistic contradictions arise. And we must always just reiterate about friends and allies and adversaries. Anyone that believes that the state, the police want to stop gang violence, you believe that Don King want to stop boxing. Okay. That is to say that there's, you know, saying that people, let's be up, a lot of people say, oh, he come Chairman Fred, he always blaming the white man and the government for, and I do, we do. But we must be upfront about this and acknowledge, and we come in very clear. It's realistically, like when Chairman Fred organized the Rainbow Coalition, I know a lot of y'all have talked to believe there was forces like Reverend Jesse Jackson had done it. When Chairman Fred organized the Rainbow Coalition, he approached as a realist. When the state tried to create antagonistic contradictions, for example, the Blackstone Rangers, who later became the Black Peace Stone Nation, we must acknowledge that that there are differences amongst us, black and brown communities, even within the black community or within the brown community. They are contradictions. They don't have to necessarily be antagonistic contradictions. So, for example, Chairman Fred went to go rap with Jeff Ford, later known as Chief Malik of the Blackstone Rangers. When he went to rap with them, the Stones' position initially was the town wasn't big enough for the Stones and Panthers, so on and so forth. But later on, they got to rapping. So Jeff Ford later on said, Chief Malik had said that we about helping the people too, but. There's no period of this, there's a comma. But we about making money. Now, a lot of people took the position, well, no, Chairman, you should try to talk to this brother, explain him, that's not the deal, so on and so forth. But as a realist, utilize the philosophical tool, this dialectical materialism, Chairman Fred, rap with this brother, so okay, that being the case, let's acknowledge that contradiction. So you don't need for me, you to be getting into it, because the state, what the government tried to do is, they tried to blend like it's all the same thing. So to create an antagonistic contradictions. Once Chairman Fred got the Stones to admit that, no, we are not a revolutionary organization. But we also can set some space where everybody can commit a revolutionary act. You follow what I'm saying? So we can avoid a lot of once we acknowledge these contradictions amongst us, and always keep what the state does is they take away all our structure. We all the same. We're not all the same. That's not saying nobody's better than nobody. But we must acknowledge our differences, utilize them, and be upfront about this. This can avoid us getting engaged in what we call antagonistic contradictions. And also just to point again, also, I wouldn't lie to the Black Power movement in the 60s, but even by the federal government's own records, and I quote them because a lot of times we don't believe nothing unless we say the federal government, the white folks said it. The federal government said when the Black Panther Party was in existence, there was a record low to what they referred to as black-on-black crime. That's a term we don't even like using, though, but the government admit that. This is an organization, that basically consists of brothers and sisters from ages 14 to 24 years old. It shook the system at its knees. I'm paraphrasing the saying they had on the plantation. It's a certain amount of freedom in fighting back. And they said when the slave killed the slave master, oppressor was gone, a new man was born. It was a cleansing process. So it's an energy out there, and it's a rage. It's a justified rage out there in the communities, whether in Oakland, Detroit, Cincinnati, so on and so forth. Our position has to be to redirect that energy, redirect that rage to work in the interests of our people.
You know, it's interesting that you said this thing about structure, and I brought up the TV shows for a particular reason, since I kind of monitor that a lot. If you watch them, what they do is they break down that structure. They always have young cats who say, I don't care about the old G's, you know, it's all about us. And they show and then they have all the bells and whistles, and the narrator goes, the little guys don't take nonsense from the older guys. And then they show them, we do our own thing out here. And the next thing you know, there's no structure, you know, as you said. And then hence that gets sent all around the country with people believing that we can do our own thing. We don't need that sort of structure. And hence maybe part of the challenge that we have. And it's very systematic. They're not showing those things on TV on 12-hour marathons for a reason. I mean, you know, without having some sort of agenda attached to it. So even though it might get ratings, there's also a political and social type of maneuvering that they want to have the masses soak up, you know, and pick up. And it is that lack of structure. When you watch those shows, ask yourself, wow, how did they get on TV and start snitching basically on their whole community? Did the police put them up to it and say, you know what I mean, and put them there with a particular agenda in mind? And that's what we probably see as the case.
One point, and this is not something that this only occurs within our community. It's a war tactic. We must be very clear that there's a war waged in our community. When Genghis Khan came through China, he got rid of the go-getters, the stand-up men amongst the Chinese community. They took away certain forces. They left a lot of the punks and puppets laying around. And this is something in our community, with, you know what I'm saying, revolutionary organizations, not these street organizations. And when I was held captive beside those concentration camps, which a lot of people call, euphemistically referred to as the prisons, when they came through Stateville, which we call Deathville, they put in isolation all the go-getters. And they locked the camps down, and they went strategically to protective custody, PC, and got those guys at a PC and put them in positions of leadership to pass up the food, so on and so forth. So they, in other words, they grabbed a runts of the litter. They grabbed a runts of our litter, and they hold up as leadership and spokespersons for organizations, in particular the American Gangster, the BT. Go listen real closely to words. People say I was around such and such. See, it's important that you, words and terms are very important. Like, you know, so they get a lot of people speak for different organizations, the street organizations, like, you know, and they grab them up now, and they say it's around, but they hold up as spokespersons. But these cats want them to get out. You follow what I'm saying? And they go to, in Iraq, they in Afghanistan, they go grab the ones who are, by all, not just by people standing, by state standards, the rapists, the criminals, they grab them. They put them in leadership. After the military defeated the Black Power movement in the 60s, they strategically, because if you be careful what you ask for, you might get it. They went through these various cities. I'm talking Cleveland, all these other cities. They grab the runts of the litter. They grab these Negroes. Say, you want a black mayor? You want a black this? You want a black? They gave it to you. But that wasn't the. We used to talk about power over our lives. So you will be very careful. You know what I'm saying? They go, see, I'm armed with a politic that is able to distinguish my cousin from my comrade. I got family members who I love, but I tell them, man. Family reunion, we can talk past the potato salad all that. When it comes to this business, this politics, stay about our business. You know, and we have to be, when it comes to our struggle, and that's what, in the street organizations, There's people up there that's membership, family membership, but they, man, they'll tell you, they don't speak for the street or for their particular organization.
That's real talk. We appreciate that. Let me pass this over to Sister Suri. Did I pronounce it correct?
Yes,
okay. You know, one of the challenges that we have as we look at trying to heal our communities, quote George, is what's going on with our sisters? You know, that seems to be a new line of attack. And that, you know, the most rapidly growing segment of the prison population. And again, you know, when we turn on the TV, we see chaos. You know, the basketball wives and the Real Housewives and all this sort of stuff that now becomes role models. I mean, I'm just saying it as a teacher. You know, that becomes the role model before the teachers themselves. And so for the work that you're doing, how do you see this? What's your analysis of this and possible solutions that we should consider?
Yes, thank you. And thank you, everyone, for coming into the panel and for being invited. I teach African American Studies at Merritt College, right up there in Oakland in the hills. Moved there only because the people were struggling and organizing in North Oakland. And we have a long history. Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale were students at Merritt College, and we were organizing. And I start off with that to say that we're in the second generation of the Black Studies movement. And being a part of that movement, what I see is that although things have changed, things have really stayed the same. And when I say that, what I mean is that we're really still on a plantation. And I know that we think that we've been freed because we think we know what slavery looked like, but we don't recognize that we're still on that plantation. We don't own, we don't control, we don't know really who we are as Black men and Black women. I mean, really who we are. And so what we do is that we're trying to raise the consciousness and awareness of really who you are as a Black man and what that means. Really who you are as a Black woman and what that means. And what's critical for us, I think, is that we turn back and we understand who we were before they captured us, colonized us, enslaved us, and changed our whole mentality. And I'm saying that in answer to your question because for Black women, many of us, we're not really clear about who we are and what our role is either. We used to govern whole nations. We used to govern whole societies. Black women have been leaders in ancient Kemet, leaders in rulership, leaders in, as doctors, leaders as business owners, long before they kidnapped us and captured us. And what we also used to do is we used to really train young girls into what it means to be a woman. That rites of passage that you hear people talking about so much, let's do a rites of passage, that was an organized, systematic way to ensure that you knew that you weren't a woman just because you turned 16 or had a baby or, you know, or started your menses, but really what womanhood was about. It's about character, it's about spiritual development, it's about the work that you do, it's about the collective understanding of your role next to the Black man in building a society. Our biggest problem to me is that we don't know really who we are. We don't know really who we are. We don't know that we governed and ruled and created civilization. That our role is not to sit and work for them. That our role is to have our own nation, build our own products, control our own lives, our own destinies. We don't even think like that anymore. It's because we've gotten so comfortable on this plantation. We think if I can just get a house in the hills and a car and some bling, then I've made it. No, you're just a better dressed slave. We got to rethink really what we need. We need to control our own communities, control our own destiny. And I was having a conversation earlier with some students about the level of frustration sometimes when we're asked to come do panels like this. And I think everyone might share this. It's like you started off. We've been having the same conversation for decades, the same conversations. When are we really gonna look at the solutions and organize and put those solutions into effect? And we can't do that unless we understand who we are, because that will lead us to an understanding of who we can be. And if we really define that, then we'll understand that we're not supposed to be living like this. We're not supposed to be treating each other like this. We're not supposed to be pimping our young girls on the street like the slave master used to do to us. We have to rethink what's happened and put it into perspective. If you've ever known someone who was an addict, who, you know, says everything's all right, I don't have a problem, everything's fine, it just keeps functioning. Have you ever known somebody like that? And you want to say, no, everything's not all right. Your behavior's not right. It's not functioning. It's dysfunctional. That's really how we're moving around as a people. We're not aware of what they have done to our minds. We're not aware of the shackles on our brains and our behavior. And until we can recognize the real root of the problem, there's no way that we can get to a solution.
Appreciate that, sister. Let me give it up for her. Minister Keith, 1995, October 17th or 16th, a lot of men were moved, to the point of tears. I mean, you saw that when the Million Man March took place. And it was a promise made that we would go forth, we would atone for our sins, we would strive to be better people, we would improve our communities. And for a period of time, we saw that crime dropped all around the nation. You know, even though police chiefs came up and said they took credit, but we knew what that was about. There was a lot of cooperation. You saw many of the artists step up and use their talents for the betterment of our community. Many of the people in this room might have been born, might have been just maybe 2, 3, 4 years old when this was happening. My question would be, based upon that moment in time, what do you think has changed that we didn't continue that, you know, level of commitment to atone and move forward, or have we? And we're just not necessarily recognizing it. And what's it going to take to return to that sort of mindset where all of us are kind of on one accord and inspired to go out and really uplift our community with the same type of vigor that we had in 95?
Well, first,
and I'm talking about the Million Man March. Yeah.
I'm honored to be here on behalf of the Honorable Louis Farrakhan.
Talk a little louder.
I begin in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. I greet all with the greeting words of peace. We say it in the Arabic language, As-salamu alaykum. First, the Million Man March is the largest and most successful gathering of black people or any people in the history of America. And though 1995 for some of our young here can mean before that they were born, or can mean when we were infantile or very young, but look how quickly the enemy has erased it from conversation. So when you go to your school and they say it's February and we're going to give you a few weeks to discover Dr. King or consider W.B. Du Bois or think about Harriet Tubman, how many of those very campuses will say what happened in October of 1995? And if they're not, why not? What was it about the Panther Party that they're not part of the curriculum? What is it about what happened in Merritt College that it seems as though there's been a movement to stop it from ever happening again? And so the Million Man March did produce the largest gathering and did cause change in the lives of tens of thousands, really uncountable men. I've done weddings of men who went home and determined they would build a family as a husband and a father out of the Million Man March. President Obama was one of the 2 million men at the Million Man March and wrote about it in his book that he was inspired there, but he was disappointed by not seeing the political connect. So he went home inspired to run for political office as a result of his being present at the Million Man March. Well, that's only to say that time will determine the value of that day, and is not yet to be determined. One of the most popular parts of the message that day was a letter read by Minister Farrakhan, written by a slave master's master by the name of Willie Lynch. When I say slave master's masters, he was a professor, if you will, for other slave masters. They didn't have Merritt College then. They had whatever place they gathered to talk about how to master black people. And one of the things that we have to be very clear about is, as someone stated earlier, we're not here by any accident. Our condition is not an unprepared circumstance. Somebody prepared us and made us into Negro. We didn't fall into calling each other by the N-word. Somebody taught us how to call each other by the N-word. That was part of the raising of a slave. And in the Willie Lynch letter, his training to the slave master was to find their differences. And in essence, to cause them to fight with one another over what they think is different. So we'll come into a room. Some of you heard me say, "Assalamu alaikum in the name of Allah." I know somebody was thinking, "I ain't no Muslim." You don't have to tell me what you were thinking, because I was sitting in your seat just a few years ago. So I am blessed and honored having sat in that seat. We are here as children of a movement that our mother Elaine was part of. And maybe in the 60s or 70s when she was speaking, we were sitting at school or sitting before a television saying, "What's wrong with them black people with Panthers on the logo?" We could have easily said that. But the reality is that what we were yesterday is not what we're becoming today. So the change that we're looking for is one that does take time to reform human thinking. Now, the greatest mistake that we make among them is that without the knowledge of self that Sister Siri was speaking to, we don't have a worthy goal for what we want. Harriet Tubman, I think it was, said, "I freed 1,000 slaves, but I could have freed 1,000 more if they in fact knew that they were slaves." So what our Sister Siri is speaking to is absolutely right. Most saw Panthers on TV and said, "Oh, they sure tough talking. What is all that about? I don't want nothing to do with that." And if you really look even at those that call themselves faithful, "I'm a Christian," but are you willing to go through what Jesus went through? Are you willing to go through what Moses went through? Are we willing to go through what Abraham went through? All of them were seen as public enemies, enemies of the state. In fact, they just published something today I saw, I think, in the Washington Post. John F. Kennedy's wife made a recording where they talked to her about Dr. King. And she thought that the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a terrible man and couldn't understand why the federal government did anything to intervene in some of the movements that he was involved with. And you already know that they thought he was a terrible man because the FBI director set about a plan to destroy him, to discredit his organization, and to drag his name through the mud. Now, they just put up a statue. Now, they were arguing in Washington that his statue was taller than George Washington's or Abraham Lincoln's, and they were angry that his stone statue was taller than their stone statue. You know you're dealing in a racist world. Now, the problem is we're trying to find a place, I think it was Too Short, who sang "Out of This City," to get in where you can fit in. Well, get in what? I don't want into that. Now, what we experienced at the Million Man March, the final call that came out after the march that covered it, had a headline that said, "A Glimpse of Heaven." In other words, being in an environment totally under our control was heaven. An environment of peace and contentment of mind. You'll never be happy as a slave. There's no such thing as a happy slave. And it doesn't matter what part of the house the slave lives in. So even the slave that lives in the big house, if they got any sense, they're looking for some glass to grind up and feed it to the master in the dinner.
And many of them did.
And many times they did.
And that's a history that gets erased.
Now,
the resistance.
Any slave that was happy is crazy. You got to be crazy to be a happy slave. A slave wants freedom, justice, and equality, and nothing less than that. They never asked us to be a citizen. They said we weren't. And then we're the only people in the history of this country that they had to modify the Constitution to consider that you're here. And when considering that we were here, that's 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, they made sure they kept a legal way to keep us as slaves. So right now, there are more of us incarcerated than there were slaves in 1850.
So there's more slaves now than there were then. So what is it that we needed? I'll stop with this. It says in the Quran, and I'm a spiritual man, so I have to give you some spiritual view. Allah says that man can have nothing but what he strives for. And what he strives for will soon be seen. And quite frankly, if we're looking for the reward, the problem is we've been left looking for it in all the wrong places. We're looking for the government to give us what we need. When quite frankly, what we need is sitting in this room. But the problem is that we've not gone after collectively what we really need as a people. It's too easy to buy a few off and point them out and say that they've achieved what they need. They've made every step of progress they ever need because our brother is president. Well, Barack Obama is president. We love him. He's our brother. But that didn't change nothing on Foothill. Has Foothill changed? Has East 14th or International Boulevard changed? They said they would make shovel-ready jobs in these jobs programs that he was speaking to on last night, but Dr. Siri said one of her students heard the speech, went to look for a job, and found out nothing changed. And that's not to say that the president doesn't have a task before him that's awesome. He has the task of being president of the Titanic. I'll stop on this point. I heard Hill Harper on CNN because he supports President Obama, and the brother deserves support from those that support him. So Hill Harper went on, and they were challenging him as to whether or not President Obama has been successful. And Hill said, well, you have to understand, he's become, in words, captain of the Titanic. And as he said that, he said, well, Hill, I hear you. That's true. It's true. He's on a ship that's heading in the wrong direction. It's heading for doom. And the rudder of that ship is not big enough to turn it away from doom. If you're captain of the Titanic, that was a fitting example because the country is really headed for doom. When you say $60+ trillion of debt, that spells doom. When you got war all over the earth, where you're seeking to steal the resources of the poor, they're not fighting in Libya to protect anybody. If they won't protect you, why would they protect somebody in Libya? If they won't protect you, why would they protect somebody in Afghanistan or Iraq? They don't care about people out there. They care about oil out there. These are gangsters you're dealing with. And we just need to know that. So if the real gang, brother has a song, Brother Jasir, we saw it yesterday with our students at our school. And in the song, he has a picture, and he shows pictures of Rupert Murdoch and others and says, this is a gangster. Right. And then they show you a picture of a young brother with a bottle in his hand or a joint in his ear or digging out of a cigar, trying to stuff it with something to make it more potent. And he points them out and says, that's not a gangster. You're not a gangster because you got a gun in the hood. You can't win a war with the little gun that they give you. Why would they give you a gun that you could win the war with? That's right. When you get shot, where are you going? Do we have a hospital? Or I talked to a family just this past Sunday where a young man was a victim of a stabbing. There was a domestic dispute. His girlfriend's ex-boyfriend came along and stabbed him up. The police came along and said he had a gun clip somewhere in his possession and took him to jail. Now, he went to the hospital as a stab wound victim. Now, he's facing his third strike. See, they're not trying to protect you. And if they allow us a weapon, they don't want you to use that weapon to protect yourself from them. So by the time they allow a weapon in our community, they know we've been dumbed down by drugs, dumbed down by alcohol, dumbed down in the public school, and won't have any idea what to do with that gun. That's why they were so frightened of the Panther Party. It wasn't a gun that they were worried about. It's what the Panthers were putting in the heads of young people that they might actually know who to point a gun at. And why. And even in some cases, how to use them. So the point here is that we have to grow into a knowledge of ourselves and gain a greater purpose than simply trying to get in where we can fit in.
Well, I think what I hear all y'all saying is that, you know, the best weapon that we have is knowledge of self, but also, you know, the ability to think at a time when they tell us that, you know, something is wrong with thinking, you know? So that's something to think, you know, to factor in.
And be careful when we go down and get stupid.
There you go. Jasiri, you're out of Pittsburgh, and I want to talk to you specifically about an organization that you've been a part of called One Hood. The reason why I want to bring this up is because y'all were looking at how to heal the community. And one of the remarkable things about the organization that you were part of is that it was made up of different people from different religious backgrounds, different sects in Pittsburgh. You know, folks that wouldn't sit in the same room with each other, but you all were able to come together and do great things. You know, whether it's starting a media academy, whether it's being on the front line for, you know, victims of police terrorism, and more importantly, you know, doing that work that when young brothers is getting shot by each other, y'all are out there, you know, trying to turn that around. From a solutionary standpoint, can you talk about how you all were able just to form a coalition with people from different sects? And I want to stress that, because oftentimes younger folks look at the fact that older folks can't get along and their public disputes are nastier sometimes than what's going on with the young people, younger folks. So,
right, and that was one of the reasons why we wanted to come together like we did, because, you know, we thought it's kind of ridiculous to go and, you know, tell, especially the young, what they call gangs, to unify, and then, you know, we find ourselves in these different traditions, whether it's Muslim, Christian, whatever, and we can't get along, or we talk bad about one another, even this church or that church or this mosque and that mosque. And then we go and say to a young person, unify, as if they can't see, you know, us arguing the different problems that we were having. But we actually were inspired by how we went to the Millions More Movement, which was the 10th anniversary of the Million Man March. We went and we got involved with an elder named Harry Belafonte and an organization he had put together called The Gathering. And so we started to kind of like travel all around the country and really begin to interact with different people in different communities. And when we came back, we didn't want it to be like we didn't want the Millions More Movement to be like a vacation. You know, sometimes we do, it's like, oh, it's a big rally and we'll go to the rally. I got a t-shirt from the rally. You know, I got really inspired. And then we'll go back into our communities and our homes and do the same thing we did and not really institute some of the principles that we learned. So when we came back and we looked at Pittsburgh, a brother that I work with real closely is a brother named Paradise Gray, who was in the rap group X-Clan. And, you know, he comes from a tradition of black nationalism. He came under the discipleship of a great man out of New York named Sonny Carson. And he looked at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and said, man, Pittsburgh suffers from hoodism. Not racism, but hoodism in our community, because, you know, we have beefs with one another. We're all in the same socioeconomic status, just like we all poor, broke, don't control anything. But yet, I don't like that person over there because somebody said that this imaginary line is this neighborhood. And then so because that person lives in that neighborhood, I don't like them. So we wanted to find a way where we can unify the community. And we came together as Muslims, you know, me, a member of the Nation of Islam, one of my best friends, a reverend in the Christian church, Paradise of Black Nationalists. We got a brother who, you know, had no religious affiliation, atheist, but he was into politics. And we all came together because, and, you know, it was another brother who's a Sunni Muslim. But we looked at it and said it's a state of emergency. We didn't have time to have philosophical arguments about what we believe in because our young people are dying and we had to move out now. We wanted to do something now. We didn't have time to write no grant or write no program and ask for no money. We need to move. And what happened was in Pittsburgh, we had, in 21 hours, we had 6 people shot. And the last 2 victims were the 3- and 4-year-old. And so at that point, we said, you know what? We have to do something, you know. And what we did was we took about 40 to 50 men, and, you know, because the traditional reaction was, oh, let's have a press conference. But for what? Because the people that are in that environment, they're not coming to a press conference. So why would you have a press conference? So we took 40 to 50 men and we started to walk the streets at night. And basically patrol our own communities. We didn't, there wasn't no money. It wasn't like if you show up, you get $8 an hour. You know, this was something that we felt we had to do because we were seeing our children being killed. And when we did it the first time, the community reaction was so powerful. You know, we had people that saw us and just, you know, women looking out the window and going to their man and saying, "I don't know what's going on down there, but you get down there and you go with them." They doing something. And so we continued to do it in the community. And what we saw was anytime we went out in our communities at night and patrolled our streets, there was no violence. So it wasn't about necessarily, but the police response, they responded to the six shootings in a 21-hour period. And what they did was they got it's called a bear, it looks like a tank. And they rolled that down the middle of the neighborhood and they had snipers on the tank. That was their response. Then they started doing what they call saturation sweeps, where they just come with the community police, the feds, the state police, and just round up anybody. And if you have you're on any type of paper, just like you said, you might have, you know, a nickel bag in your pocket, you going to prison. That was their response. And one of the reasons why they were doing this response in this particular area, because it was an area that they're seeking to gentrify. And so they wanted to go clean up that area so then they could take over the area. They could put Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and these corporations up and then move black people out and then move another people in. So we started to fight that. We had a situation where an officer pointed a gun at a 7-year-old girl and said he was going to blow her brains out. Pulled the mom over because she had expired stickers. Instead of coming to the driver's side, he went to the passenger side and he had his gun pulled. The little girl, she's trying to struggle to get out of the seatbelt because she's scared. And he said, if this little girl does not stop moving, I'm going to blow her brains out. So we organized around that in terms of bringing awareness to that and putting the officers there.
But they arrested the mom.
They arrested the mom for disorderly conduct because she called on Jesus because she thought this crazy man was going to kill her daughter. And they arrested her. And eventually, you know, because of her organizing, they dropped the charges. But the policeman, he admitted he drew his gun, but he said that he had it pointed at the ground. When have you ever seen a policeman pull his gun out and point it at the ground? As if the ground is going to jump up and try to harm him. Unless you're on the ground, right? He's standing over you. Thank you very much. And then 6 months later, that same police officer killed a mentally disabled Asian man 6 months later. But what we saw, you know, we were kind of, at this point, being reactionary. And, you know, the reactionary, it got like, we got a lot of press. You know, we were in the paper, we were on TV, but we really didn't see that change that we really wanted. And what we felt we had to do was begin to really invest in our young people's future. If knowledge itself is needed, then we have to create programs where we can teach knowledge itself unhindered. You know, unhindered to our people. And so we became, successful, myself in Paradise, because we do these rap videos. You know, I did a video about Oscar Grant's murder because I was here in Oakland when the rebellion happened. And I just felt the spirit of the people. And I went home on a plane and I wrote a song dedicated to Oscar Grant. But we started to do these political conscious videos. And really, I look at myself as a propagandist. You know, see, I'm sitting next to my brother. You know, when you hear what they call mainstream or popular rap, it's propaganda for this society. So what do you hear? Get money, you know, get cars, get clothes, get alcohol, go to the bar, spend your money, make it rain. And at the end of all of those, you know, activities, it's not somebody look like us. Because we don't own the car corporations. Oftentimes we don't own the club. We're not giving out the loans. We definitely don't own the record companies. So what we looked at, we were doing as we created those rap videos, is we began to create our own media. And so, and I'll end with this. Pittsburgh, they did a study of the media in Pittsburgh and how it relates to black men, specifically young black men. And they found out that 98% of it was negative. 98% of the time when it was any young black man in the media, what is it? Picture, you going to jail, you going to prison. So because we had become successful creating our own media, we said, okay, well, this is what we want to do in response to the study. We want to create a media academy. And so we got a group of young boys together and we started to teach them, okay, we can't wait for NBC, ABC, CNN to do positive stories and medias on us. We've been waiting. We have to create them themselves. And we have YouTube and Facebook and Twitter. And we have all these social networks. We can create our own media and put our own media out. And because of me, myself and Paradise Success in rapping and creating our own videos, this is what we do for a living now. And so we began to train young people because now we get media clients. Because now we One Hood Media, David. Because ultimately, just like you said, if you're not going to go get a grant, and we didn't want to go get a grant as One Hood because we didn't want a foundation to be able to tell us what we could and couldn't do. But we need money. We need resources. We need to be fed. So we had to create a business and economics in order to do that. So when we created One Hood Media and we began to teach our young people media, we said, okay, well, what's the curriculum? So we gave all the young people in the class, the book we started out with was The ISIS Papers by Dr. Francis Cress Wilson. Because they have to understand, when he mentioned the structure, it's a structure in place that many of us don't understand. And sometimes when it comes up, we're afraid to even talk about it, and it's called white supremacy. We have to understand it. It's a structure of white supremacy. It exists, and we're victims of it. And if we don't, and she says in the book, if you don't understand white supremacy, then you'll never really understand how America works. And so that's the first part of freeing them. So we gave them this text and curriculum. Now we got them blogging, we have them editing video, and we have them, now they're going to be the people that go out in the community and get the real stories and expose the real stories, and we're going to put them out. And so that's kind of how we develop as One Hood. But along the way, you know, other individual members of One Hood, pressure was put on us. You know, so One Hood, as we started, is the One Hood how you see it today. Because pressure was put on certain members, and certain members couldn't withstand that pressure. Offers were given to certain members for jobs, and certain members left to get a job because of the success of One Hood. You know, because this is how the enemy works. And the biggest, resistance that we got was from established black leadership. Because established black leadership felt like we were coming, we were the new thing in town, and we was going to come and we was going to take all that grant money. And oftentimes, this is why the reason you say, well, how come all these organizations can't get together, and how come? It's because oftentimes those organizations are all fighting for the same little bitty pot of money. It's the same reason you don't see McDonald's and Burger King coming together. But they're going for the same customer. And so to really begin to truly create unity for ourselves, it can't come from an idea of we got to create a program. Right, to be funded. It has to come from an idea of, no, we have to come together and save our people by any means necessary. And if we come from that spirit of sincerity, the money will come. The resources will come. Because God is going to provide for his people, but we have to be fearless. We can't be afraid. And we can't and we have to do something for ourselves and build businesses and an economy for ourselves.
Let's give it up for our panel right here. I'm sure there's a number of people that are in the audience that may want to add on to some of the stuff that we've heard, have some questions or anything like that. So let's feel free to do that as we kind of unfold, you know, some of this, digest some of the things that we were fed. One of the things, I'll just toss a question out while we're waiting for anybody who wants to comment, is we were talking about how we could create unity within our community. How do we do that culturally, crossing into the boundaries? How can Black unify more solidly with Brown and vice versa? And in a place like this, we have Asian comrades and what have you. How do we build, you know, those bridges? Because that seems to be a major weapon that's used against us now to divide us along ethnic lines. And maybe somebody could speak to that.
One of the lessons we learned here in Oakland around the Oscar Grant incident And it didn't begin there, but it provides a great example. And that is the issue that we're debating, or that we're arguing, or we're fighting for, is bigger than what we think are our differences. So some may remember we had weekly town hall meetings at a church. And while there were some who, in their political way, may have felt intimidated or not as free to express themselves in church if that's not your environment, but the reality is that because we met at church, it made it easier for those who maybe had difficulty with hearing from a Muslim. It provided an environment, they had the facilities, and when we met there at Olivet, we had there with us black, brown, red, yellow, white, gay, straight, undecided, whatever our issues were, because the issue wasn't what is it you call your lifestyle. The issue was, how do we get justice for Oscar Grant? So we keep our focus on the issue. So we did our best that while we were presenting ourselves not to bring what maybe some may have felt to be the criticisms of individual lifestyles. I turned on the news yesterday, and I saw some of our friends from the town hall at the BART station in San Francisco. And while I wasn't there, because I have not found it suitable on some occasions to just volunteer myself to be arrested, I don't believe in nonviolent demonstration. Meaning, in other words, if the police hit me in the head, I'm hitting them back. So we have found it not so suitable for those kind of, for me. But if for you, you can make your point doing that, then fine. Go ahead, Christoph. Who they took him a week or two to figure out that brother's name. But he came to every town hall, came to every meeting at the BART station, and presented an object or a theme called No Justice, No BART. But I knew what I was looking at. I was looking at someone who was sincere enough about the issue that he would sacrifice himself, his time, and his talent to raise the debate. And there are many issues that came from Christoph and others. He wasn't alone. From Siri and others. From Davey and others that said, this is how we should frame the argument around this issue. And we did our best to listen to all of these thoughts and ideas so we could present the most concise, cogent argument that was required to win the debate. So the question wasn't, what was the skin color? What was the faith tradition of those that brought the argument? Were it not for some that others may not have considered at the table? I'll give you an example. I was at Allen Temple today. I had the blessing to sit with my brother, J. Alfred Smith, the senior. When we challenged the district attorney to bring charges against Johannes Mezeli, had I been the first one to the door, he probably wouldn't have opened the door. He opened the door for the Reverend Dr. J. Alfred Smith, Sr. Now, if he doesn't open that door, maybe we don't have a meeting that says, what are you going to do, when are you going to do it, and how long is this going to take? And were it not for the fact that he was willing to let Pastor Smith, who's my senior, he's a Christian, I don't know his age, I think he's about 72. If he didn't have those factors involved, we may have never had the meeting. So there are some in their youth, you can stand outside and chant strong, but at a certain point, if you're expecting policy change or political movement, you got two choices. You stay on the outside and fight it out, or we go on the inside and learn how to fight on the inside. And there may be a time that we'll have to stand on the outside and just fight.
They're not mutually exclusive. Okay. Right. Any questions out there or comments from anybody? Anybody? Go ahead. In the back right there? Okay.
All right, my name is Rodney, and I wanted to speak to the statement you made about unifying black and brown. And one of the things that crossed my mind was, I think it was the Mexican-American War back in the 1700s or 1800s, whenever it was. One of the issues with that war was pushing slavery out to the West, Texas, Arizona, California, whatever. And the Mexican, I call them Native American. They was here first, from the top of Canada all the way to the bottom of Mexico. The issue with that was they wasn't having no slavery. They wasn't for that. So, I mean, how I see it, they were standing up for us.
Right.
Now, you come all the way to whatever, 2011, and like I see like in LA, you know, it's Mexicans versus blacks out there, but somewhere in between the Mexican-American War and us fighting today, we forgot about what the issue was, why they wasn't letting the slavery be pushed out to the West or whatever, so.
I think you make a good point, and it kind of dovetails off of what Chairman Fred was saying about structure, and maybe George or somebody can speak to that, but the information that you just gave, they don't teach it in schools anymore.
Right.
And not only are they not teaching it, but now they're passing laws all around the country to limit what sort of ethnic studies you can even teach. So in the state of Texas, where I do a lot of work, you know, my other half, you know, they will like fire her from being a school teacher if she starts talking about Cesar Chavez to her students. You know, they changed the textbooks, you know, and don't have Panthers. They didn't want to have Dolores Huerta in there. They didn't want to have all kinds of people. They didn't even want to mention the name slavery in there, the word slavery in the textbooks. In Arizona, you know, they where they had SB 1070, people were looking and saying, well, that's an immigration bill. They were forgetting that at the same time that they was passing that anti-immigration bill, that they were also banning ethnic studies. And the way they did the divide and conquer was they put a brown face on the ethnic immigration thing and said, all these people are coming in illegally, let's kick them out. And then you had, sadly, some people who looked like us that was going, yeah, they need to get out, not realizing that they were holding up a black face to say, let's get rid of ethnic studies. And the person doing it was the same one, a neo-Nazi named Russell Pierce. You know, and so that sort of tactic is what they're doing to break down structure and keep us forever confused. So I think that's good that you brought that up. And we should take note of that. Go ahead, Elaine. Sister Elaine.
There's a tendency to not look at some practical questions also, because I think what people might have missed Fred Hampton Jr. here saying is that Fred Hampton Sr. Created a thing we called in the Black Panther Party, which he invented this term, the Rainbow Coalition, first starting with Chacha Jimenez and the Young Lords, and then with other groups. But part of that is that you got to do some work. It's nice that we can understand that history, but when we started when the Black Panther Party united with the Brown Berets formed because of the Black Panther Party. They said, wait a minute, you got black power, we ought to have brown power. And they liked that idea, and I was there in 1968 when the Brown Berets in LA formed and came together with the Black Panther Party and announced that we were united in coalition. That did not mean we were the same people. Half the Negroes and none of us ever learned how to speak Spanish, to my chagrin. I'm ashamed to say something that ignorant. We didn't know all of that. We never went down to a certain neighborhood. We knew they had what they were doing in the barrios, we can say, what we were doing in the black community. So there's a question of practical, whether you're ready to get down and say to your brothers and sisters. Now, on the love question, that's the spiritual, emotional part of it. But there's a practical question. If you got 100 guns and the Brown Berets got 100 guns, you now have 200 guns. So, I mean, it's really not that complicated. You ain't got to fall in love. You don't have to appreciate even the history. You might appreciate it. But what you do have to recognize is that we're standing on common ground.
That's right.
And when you recognize that we're standing on common ground, and this is not your enemy, ain't no Chicano arresting you and putting you owning all of things that affect our communities. This is not our enemy, even if it wanted to be our enemy, any more than the Crip is the enemy of the blood. These people are not our enemies. The last thing I want to mention on this is the same thing, because Fred Hampton was a wonderful man, but what you don't realize is that Fred Hampton was 21 years old when he was assassinated. 21. So when people sit up here and ask me what I've been doing over these last years, old as I am, I'm sitting up here old as dirt. 68 years old. Don't talk about no Alfred Smith being no 72. Got to be much older than that. But anyway, I'm old as dirt. All of you have to know that Fred Hampton was 19 when he was speaking about the Rainbow Coalition, and 21 when he was assassinated by the FBI. Why? because he did was able to bring together those people. Even when the FBI tried to divide Jeff Ford, and I don't know if you understand who Jeff Ford was, but Jeff Ford was the leader of the largest street organization in the United States called the Peacestone Nation, which became ultimately the El Rucan, right, and so forth and so on. And when the FBI attempted to divide Fred Hampton and Jeff Ford because they knew what a powerful combination that would be, they didn't go for it, but mostly Fred didn't go for it. So you have to be the courageous one and say, all right, that's wonderful about the history. Well, I got some other stories we could tell that might not be so wonderful, but the point is we all in the same boat. As Fred just said, we may have contradictions, but we don't have to have antagonistic contradictions. We may not like each other. You know black people running around here talking about Mexicans like a dog. Now let's face fact, you might be the one black person that says you didn't do it, but I'm telling you that black people on the down low will talk about some Mexicans like a dog. And Mexicans, I lived in Georgia, will say black people trying to get their money because they're coming in illegally and they're making a lot of cash and they get paid by cash. There's all kinds of divisions going on, but that doesn't mean that we can't recognize the contradictions, as Brother Fred said, and come together. But his father brought those people together almost before anyone did and created what he called the Rainbow Coalition, talking about black power to black people, brown power to brown people, red power to red people, yellow power to yellow people. And of course, we always said Panther power to the vanguard, but that's another story. So let's talk about some practical solutions. You do need to know your history. If you don't, that was the fifth point of the Black Panther Party program. We want to know our true history and true nature of our oppression. But now we have to get on the ground right now. There is absolutely no reason why we can't be in coalition with Latinos and with brown people when they are the next people in line. And they need to recognize that we do, and we can find our way around whatever contradictions we think we have between them. And we don't have to reach back. We can look at the common ground, who's on the ground getting shot by the police, who's going to prison, blah, blah. So I just wanted to bring up this, because sometimes we get, I mean, I'm not one of those people. I'm probably one of the people Brother Jasiri X was talking about was the odd man out in the coalition they formed. I'm the one with the more, not so spiritual, you know. That's a nice version of it, right? But anyway, so what I'm saying is this example is here for you, and it came from young people, younger than you, Fred Hampton, 19 years old. When I heard him speak, he was 20 years old, and he was galvanizing people around issues in very concrete ways and bringing black, brown, and all kinds of people together at 19 years old, 20 years old.
Anybody else want to add that, George? Anybody want to add that? Yeah, pass it to George for a minute.
I would like to say thank y'all for the privilege to speak and share my opinion. I appreciate all the wise words spoken, and in so many words, y'all make me feel like y'all talking about me for some reason. I don't know if it's prophetic. Tell you how you want to take it. But let me get to my point. I feel that what's really lacking collectively, what all of you guys have said, is the culture standpoint and us not being able to speak the language of our fathers, us not having that culture, us losing touch with the spirit of the African. Because we are African. We're not Americans, period. I don't care how y'all want to say it, how y'all look at it, whoever want to contest what I'm saying, we're Africans born in America. Period. Lost it, better words. But ultimately, I feel that we do need to come amongst each other, and we need adults and leaders like yourselves to come and actually put your hands on some of these young folks. Get some of these young folks to intern and actually shadow what's going on to really get those in-depth lessons and that understanding. Some people don't want it, but there are those of us who seek it. And who know what's real, who know the truth, and who will stand firm in what we believe and what we know is going on. And a lot of these issues that we're all facing, we are the solution to it.
That's right.
Right here, right now, everybody who has taken part in this meeting, even to those people who haven't seen this yet, who will see it soon enough, we are the solution. And until we come together and put aside our differences, it's all reciprocating. Everything that you're saying is everything that the youth panel may end up saying when we come up there, but from a youth, more so a younger perspective. And man, ultimately, let's just do it. It ain't nothing else to do it. Like you said, by any means necessary. If today was our last day. Will we want to just go out knowing we just sat down and had this discussion? It was powerful. This is a lot, you know, a lot of knowledge given and shared. But yeah, what's, you know what I mean? What's really going to change through what we're saying? I've been to these kinds of meetings and city town hall council meetings since I've been 14, 15 years old. God bless me to see the age of 20. And because it's a lot that goes on out here. So that's enough said in so few words. But it's all been the same thing. It's like a repeat.
That's right.
I don't get no justice or no answers to the issues. There are solution-based issues. I mean, there's not solutions to our issues, basically. And they're not going to give us solutions. And they, you know who I'm talking about. So we have to come up with and make our solutions concrete. We have to build this foundation with ourselves. And you guys have young individuals amongst you, like I said, that are willing. So to the people and to all, take it how you want to take it. It's been said, and I can't say it no more.
Well, that's a powerful solution, you know, right there. Appreciate that. Anybody else? Anybody else want to holler before we wrap up? Last words from anybody on the panel then? Yeah, go ahead, pass that to George, and then we'll go to the Chairman Frey.
I just wanted to piggyback on a couple of the comments. You know, Brother Keith referred to kind of the Willie Lynch syndrome and the divide and conquer, and we talked a little bit about the root of the Rainbow Coalition and just how those movements were kind of destroyed through COINTELPRO and some of those different kinds of things. And what we haven't really talked about is how that's really happening even right now, so that we can kind of begin to kind of build and move beyond that, so we don't let it to continue to destroy us, right? You know, in 1993, in the wake of the LA uprising and the Rodney King verdict, you know, you had a lot of unity momentum going on all across not only Los Angeles but urban centers across the nation. In Los Angeles, you would see graffiti sprawl that said "Crips, Bloods, and Essays United," and that would be the first thing that LAPD would try to erase and take down. And what they found out through Rampart scandal and other things, that the LAPD in cooperation with the FBI would dress up as folks from different neighborhoods to get the beef going again. So they would dress up in blue, roll to a red neighborhood, get it started again in order to instigate the violence, because they have a vested interest in us killing and destroying each other like that. And what they've also done is created this new age McCarthyism, where they've targeted one of my close brothers who was part of the Gathering for Justice too, Alex Sanchez from Homies Unidos. You know, what he did is he had started a street organization way back in the day called the Mara Salvatrucha, who was labeled in the post 9/11 political climate as the largest domestic terrorist organization in the nation. But in fact, what he's doing is he's been a community peace worker. He founded an organization called Homies Unidos, and he's been doing work between El Salvador, Honduras, the United States, building peace and really getting to the root causes of these issues for over 15 years now. And now he's being targeted by the feds and FBI, and that case is still ongoing. And most recently, one of our elders, Carlos Montes in Los Angeles, who was a founder of the Brown Beret movement, which some folks made reference to, is being targeted as well by the FBI for his continued political activism, particularly around immigrant rights and what's been happening in Arizona and some of those types of issues. And so we're actually, we need to continue to build, continue to organize. So we have to have these conversations, but it can't just be a dialogue. It has to be a strategy session. So building on what this brother's talking about, it has to be a strategy session where we begin to build about what are we going to do, in fact, about this? How are we going to make sure that they don't continue this divide and conquer? And how are we going to build our communities? How are we going to elevate the voice and the power of the young people? Because we know that's where a lot of our solutions are coming from. We're having a fundraiser today. I'm going to do a plug for Carlos Montes. It's going to be at Eastside Cultural Center, 2277 International Boulevard. It's for his legal defense fund. Part of the proceeds will go for him. Part of the proceeds will also go for the other thing we destroy that's being destroyed and attacked, which is ethnic studies. And Arizona, for particularly the brown community, has been ground zero in a lot of these attacks, in which they've been targeting immigrants and they've also criminalized ethnic studies, particularly in Tucson. And so this is a fundraiser to support the folks who are organizing to maintain ethnic studies, because once again, we know that there's power and that you need to know where you're going. In order to know where you're going, you need to know where you come from, right? As Frederick Douglass said, right? What did he say?
Oh, conceive nothing without.
That's right. Right. Well, I was referring to a person without a history is like a tree without roots. And so we need to know our roots, we need to know where we're going. And so ethnic studies is important to protect. So there's a fundraiser today. One more plug I just wanted to kind of say too is that, frankly, our women have been carrying our communities. That's the truth. That's true in the brown community, it's true in the red community, and I'd imagine that's true in the black community too, you know? And one of our elders in the American Indian Movement said that, you know, if you teach a man, you teach an individual, but if you teach a woman, you teach a nation, because our mothers are our first teachers, right? But what they talked about with this invasion, you know, since 1492, which also opened up the way for slavery and uprooting people of African descent, colonizing them here, but particularly for us as First Nations people, what they talked about was by destroying the sacred hoop, they took the men out of the equation. And to restore that sacred hoop, to heal it, amend it, to make things, to restore our families and our communities, our nations, we need to bring the boys and men back in a sacred manner. Not in a paternalistic way, because we've internalized a whole lot of misogyny where we hate our women. We hear it in our music. We disrespect our women all day, up and down, right? Every day. And so part of that work is also men's, boys and men's healing work. And that's the other thing we're doing. So part of the event we're having tonight is called Mujeres en Ceremonia. That means women in ceremony. But as brothers, we're going there to support our sisters, our mothers, our daughters, and nieces, and like that. So I just want to extend the invitation for y'all to kind of come and support and to really build, not just take this as rhetoric, but we're going to, you know, support each other. You know, y'all come over, check out our event today, and we can continue to support each other's events and continue to organize and have this dialogue. Thank you.
I'm getting the time to wrap up, so I guess you get the last word there, Chairman Fred, in about 2 minutes.
I just want to commend some of the points that we just brought out about the whole thing about the counter-surge, the COINTELPRO, about people getting locked up, the federal government vamping on people. Now, to my fellow countrymen in particular, African, and to our people in general, I hear what you're saying about the cultural thing, but not to be hard-nosed, but I just really want this, I can't stress this scientific summation, how important it is. We definitely can't leave out here romanticized revolution. And some things I didn't talk about, because a lot of times we romanticize struggle. We talk about the Rainbow Coalition, that the record reflect that the young patriots, a group of poor whites out of the Appalachian Mountains, at one point were so reactionary, these cats was wearing Confederate flags on their jackets. You know what I'm saying? So let's be, when Chairman Freeman went to go meet with the Stones, before Jeff Ford, before Chief Malik came down, there was another a guy who was in leadership position of the Stones, who was pushing for a war between the Stones and the Panthers, who was later on exposed as FBI informant. This is the guts that we got to talk about in struggle. You know what I'm saying? Because a lot of times the stuff moving just died away, or it's just simple, we just get together. No. I think black people in particular, we speak French too much a lot of times. We say we at the wrong times. We all not the same, you know what I'm saying? And it's not just in our people in particular. With the American Revolution, I know a lot of y'all call it with the Patrick Henry thing, and he told you in school, everybody was saying, give me liberty, give me death. Nonsense. This criminal Thomas Jefferson told you 1/3 of them was for it, 1/3 was against it, and 1/3 went whichever way the wind blew. That's how it is in our struggle. Yeah. I know we see a lot of films back in the days. We see a lot of the protests, the Oscar Grant. A lot of people came for different opportunist reasons. People get involved in relationships, opportunists, all, and that's the reality. Richard Pryor says a peopleologist. I consider myself a peopleologist also. I study people. Now, if you believe that everybody came to the Black Panther Party Free Breakfast Program because it's interested in socialism, fighting for the people, I got a pink elephant outside I got to sell you. Because real, you know what I'm saying, we must be upfront about that. Because I know we set ourselves up to be demoralized. You feel what I'm saying? We must be upfront. And we, you know, feel that seize the time. What that means is a certain, me and Mortar Tech, we get engaged to the Black and Brown Tour. It's important that I point out that we was able to form this coalition with the brown community. I forget, the brown community in particular was under attack. I forgot the piece of legislation that was coming, the government was coming down on him. So it might be the right time. You follow what I'm saying? That's what everybody don't come to conscious at the same point. People get involved in struggle one of three ways. Quote me on this. Inspiration, aspiration, or desperation. Yeah, he turns more than me black. He turns more than me black. No disrespect to the dead. A lot of y'all do Michael Jackson. Initially he said, don't make a difference, you black or white. When they came with that case on his ass, his song changed the world. They don't care about us. Kobe Bryant started quoting Dr. King when he caught the case. I can't tell you how many brothers and sisters I was on the street talking to, they told me, Chairman Free, I'm not into that political shit you're talking about. When I met him in state bill with 75 years, all of a sudden, man, the concentration camps are brutal. I'm sure you see that now. So these are necessary ingredients that we must have in struggle. It's not just this simplistic, so that's an insult to struggle to say we just get together and do this here. I had a struggle with one of my forces 2 days ago in Chicago. He always come with this whole, also say this too, other side of the race contradiction also. Again, we now in Nazi Germany, some all the one against Adolf Hitler. Some of them was fun, some they benefited. Some of the so-called Jews, they was up with it. In our community, all of us don't want the same thing. You'd be surprised. Yeah. So aside from the race contradiction, there's some class contradictions also. In fact, in this struggle, there's going to be a class contradiction. It's going to be the clash of the titans. They're like child's play. We have to be up front and deal with opposition. We take the heat to Sam and Sambo, the gringo and the negro. You know what I'm saying? And we must be upfront about that, man. This brother told one of my forces the other day. He has this romanticism, this idealism about struggle. Because he has no practical get out in the street with the, you know what I'm saying? He has this abstract idealism. And it's an insult to struggle. It's an insult to the work that we do out here, man. So the guy tells me the other day, he said, man, Chairman, I was at the school the other day, and his sister was, I was telling her how the children were marching to the school is like they do in prison. And then she said, well, man, no, that's for discipline. And he said, no, that's like prison. And then she went back and said, well, you're right. And she went back to the school and addressed that. So he ran this romanticism jive to me, to my C channel. A lot of people just don't know. I said, what you telling me is like telling the cook all the flour and the egg and the batter got to do is get together and make a cake. You forget the necessary ingredient, my man, heat. Let me ask you one more question. Was her child one of them children? He said, yeah. I said, you forgot that point. Her child was being fucked over. You feel what I'm saying? So if you see the time, that's on people themselves. This grandmother, Daryl Hamilton, shot 15 times Chicago Police Department, December 2nd, 2002. I'm going to quote that grandmother in my clothes. She said, man, she said, Chairman Fred, I just said, I've been seeing you in the news. I've been hearing about you locked up. I've seen your name scraped on the wall. I couldn't really hear you till they gunned my grandbaby down. Feel what I'm saying? So these are necessary conditions that it takes with struggle. Not just that we just enlighten them. It has to happen, man. It's a necessary, you can't, the flour and the egg and the batter just don't get together. What did he do? Don't forget that part. And we say the state don't bring the heat, we didn't bring the heat. The real talk. Dwayne, D Slade Wade, Dwayne, the basketball player, actually, we got on this motherfucking ass the other night. We don't let nothing move. We have to up the end. We artists, everybody, you know what I'm saying? Put the pressure on them. Feel what I'm saying? People get involved in struggle one of three ways. Again, I repeat, man, inspiration, aspiration, or desperation. All that abstract idealism, they just came together and got together. No, was a certain thing. And also, relationships, when I was locked up, I'm close for real this time. No, seriously. When I was in the state field, the white cats, the prisoners, was the only ones able to get their mail out. So I got this guy with the Aryan Brotherhood sending the mail out. All the other prisoners tell me, Chairman, dude is a racist. But I said, oh, let me be very clear with y'all. I'm able to form scientific relations. I wouldn't be fooling with a lot of y'all if I wasn't locked up. You feel what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? So Che Guevara, Malcolm X, they said, no permanent friends, no permanent enemies, permanent interests. So don't you, it's certain forces that was doing progressive things in the 60s, man, in certain recent history. Like clothes. Don't show me no old picture of me say, man, Chairman, you were wearing the bell bottoms to be shot. What year was that? What was the time? What was the conditions? You know what I'm saying? So again, we have to be informed. It's certain forces that take Chicago. We know they united with us in certain campaigns. We're going to go protest their ass a week later. You follow what I'm saying? What's the issue? You know what I'm saying? I can always, man, have your ear to the ground, studying the conditions, not in this abstract, everything in absolutes. The relationships, things are constantly evolving, constantly disintegrating, you know what I'm saying? You know what I'm saying? With the relationship, and it's been tied to the state has used the Buffalo Soldiers, black people against brown people. There's times when they use brown community against black people, you know what I'm saying? But before you form coalition with anybody, take the Black Panther Party, because POCC mantra, no respect, no rap. We don't form no coalition with nobody. Whether you black, brown, or white, whatever it is, man, no respect, no rap. That's a mandatory criteria you gotta have, a respect. And again, seize the time, assess, might be the right timing. You feel what I'm saying? Power to the people.
Well, we're gonna wrap it up. Let's get up for our panel again. Thank you.
guys be able to